out of it.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. A soldier's life isn't supposed to be easy, but there's a growing sense in America that the military is falling out of step with the rest of society. Stories of servicemen and women on welfare and deteriorating conditions on bases reach right up to the commander-in-chief. In his last radio address, that's where President Bush set his sights.
Much has changed over the past two centuries for the people who wear the uniform of the United States. Our armed forces have grown into the mightiest on earth, and their responsibilities extend all over the world. Yet the courage and patriotism of our servicemen and women are as sure and as strong as ever. And we owe them the same appreciation that we feel for the soldiers of Bunker Hill, Valley Forge, and Yorktown. We owe them fair salaries, first-class health benefits, and decent housing. And what we owe, we will pay.
There's little doubt more money for the troops would help, but the people who look carefully at the armed services say problems are bigger than just infrastructure and income, that the military isn't a Fortune 500-style organization easily fixed by a sharp HR department. The quality of life for people in the military is about the roof over their heads and the food on their table. It's also about their understanding and confidence in their mission and the inspiration they get from their superiors. Connection listeners, it's a different military. What should the new kind of soldier, sailor, and airman expect? What's the cost of squeezing more missions out of fewer soldiers? And is the nature of need to know changing? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests today are Joyce Razor. She's Associate Director of Government Relations for the National Military Family Association. Andrea Stone is a reporter with USA Today who covers the military, and retired Colonel Dr. Gail Watkins, a 23-year veteran of the Army and president of Clovebrook Enterprises. That's a research firm that has examined the military. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Andrea, I'd like to begin with you, if I could, because you've been reporting on the military for several years, and I need a picture from you. Who is the military today? What's wrong with our own sense or our old sort of perceptions of the military?
Well, it's a very different, it's much smaller military than it was before the Cold War ended. Before the Cold War ended, there were over 2 million members, service members. Today, there's under 1.4. There's been a third of the force has been cut. It's a much more diverse workforce. Right now, minorities make up 41% of the military. 30 years ago, they were 15%. There are many more women. In 1971, before the rules were changed to allow women to stay in, even if they became pregnant, less than 2% of the military were women. Today, it's almost 15%. 52% are married. In the old days, the vast majority, at least of enlisted people, were single and didn't have to worry about spouses or children. They could live in the barracks. They didn't need bedrooms for children.
And where are they living today, Andrea? When you go to the bases, what do you see that's different?
I see they're living on base and off base, but they're not. The housing on base is really substandard. Very old, falling apart. The ones who are living off base, all military people do get a housing allowance, but those who live off base right now are penalized. They don't get the same amount of benefit as those who manage to get base housing. So there is an effort underway right now to get rid of that gap, that disparity, and to increase the housing allowance for people who live off base. And there's also a big push to privatize housing, to get private industry involved in building really nice housing for the troops, which the military thinks would cost the military less money and also give a better product to the service people.
Andrea, let me bring Joyce in here. Joyce Razor, your husband is active duty Army, and you spend your time advocating for military families like your own. Give me a sort of shorthand of what you're working on, the images that we have of the falling down barracks and people on food stamps. Is that an accurate bit of shorthand?
Well, I think the falling down infrastructure, the housing, Andrea put it very well. I mean, there's inadequate substandard housing on an installation, and housing off the installation is priced out of the range for a lot of folks, and so they're living in, a lot of the young folks are living in worse conditions off the base than they are on. Our family, it's a family force. Andrea talked about demographics. This is a family force, and so that's why our association works so hard on some of these issues. Housing, health care, education for children, opportunities for spouse employment. Military folks today want the same quality of those things, of that kind of life, housing, health care, education, spouse employment, as the people they're charged to defend expect. And to ask military folks to accept any less is doing them an injustice.
So when you listen to President Bush say, I'm going to pay what I owe, here's the extra money that I think people living on and off base need, is that the whole answer? Is that completely satisfactory to you?
It's a start. One of the most important reasons it's a start is that it tells the military families and the members that someone has heard their concerns and is trying to do something about them. I mean, the services have dug themselves into a hole, especially on infrastructure, especially on housing. It's going to take a while to come out of that. But the fact that the administration is putting more money into quality of life, the quality of life component, is a big start. And families out in the field recognize that it's not going to happen overnight, but appreciate the fact that somebody's listening and responding.
Colonel Watkins, you were in the Army for more than 20 years, and you've just done a study where you talked with a lot of people in the forces about the mission and how they feel about it. Does it come down to the real hard practical issues that Joyce and Andrea are describing, or are you finding there's more to it than that?
We certainly found that there was more to it. It isn't that pay and benefits and quality of life are unimportant, but people clearly state that they don't come in the Army to get rich. They come in because they want to feel what they do is important, meaningful, that it really is their calling. These are people who want to make a difference in the world. And if you think about it, we really want what we've called professionals, people who do take this on as their calling, in charge of one of the world's most lethal forces. We don't necessarily want a numb bureaucracy making these life or death decisions. And so we spoke to primarily officers worldwide to get a feeling of their understanding of their own profession.
Were you surprised by what you heard?
We were surprised. We had a number of findings that we were unexpected, particularly since we were talking to officers who are, we focused on entry-level to mid-level management, and they face fewer of the quality of life problems, and we thought that they perhaps would be more satisfied, and found that they felt stifled in many ways. They felt particularly by checklists and centralized decision-making and things like that. They felt like they could not use their professional expertise. Their time was occupied overwhelmingly by taking care of soldiers, of dealing with many of the issues that Joyce and Andrea have spoken to, that left little time for them to practice their profession of logistics or warfighting or whatever their specialty was.
But isn't it by its nature a very bureaucratic organization and some, that's never going to change?
Well, certainly the fact that the Army is a bureaucracy will never change, but the degree to which individuals within it can apply their professional expertise has changed. At one point in time, commanders or senior NCOs were given a tremendous amount of autonomy to use their professional judgment. I think the change is very similar to what's happened with doctors and HMOs, and the stifling of the ability to apply professional knowledge and expertise. To these officers, honestly, the only way to describe it was they were anguished in their concern that their inability to use their professional expertise was going to perhaps risk the lives of their soldiers and their units.
Joyce and Andrea, I'm interested in knowing from you two, when you listen to Colonel Watkins talk about how you can't separate the roof and the food from these larger sort of psychological or confidence issues. Do you hear that as well?
Oh, yes, I do. It was interesting, as I was listening to Dr. Watkins, I kept thinking that a lot of the frustration she was describing among the officers is what I hear from spouses, both enlisted and officer spouses, about their frustrations with their finding a career or not being able to have a career, looking for that extra help for family income, but also the career satisfaction that comes from spouses. We have an educated force, and an educated force also has educated family members. And so we have people who want to use skills that are moving every 2.9 years with the military member and having to start over again on a career cycle. So I hear that. And I also hear the sense of pride. I mean, that's one thing I always hear from families is that they are proud of what the member does, of what they are doing to contribute to that mission. They just want the recognition for that.
I think also that was a good point about the tours being 2.9 years. Some of the things that the new administration is looking at is to change the personnel system, which has been so rigid, maybe to have longer tours so that families aren't uprooted so often, and so that once a soldier gets to a place that they can become experienced in their current position and not have to leave just as soon as they're getting the hang of it. And there's also some thought to getting rid of the military's up and out system for officers, where you have a certain amount of time as a captain and you either get promoted or you have to get out. Why do people have to leave when they're at the prime of their careers in their mid-40s? But that's what happens in the military. So there's a thought to looking at that system and changing it.
And Colonel Watkins, when we talk about the money side of the way the president wants to address this, I'm wondering if you're seeing within that any sense of these issues that we're discussing. Is the Pentagon, are the brass aware of these?
Well, certainly they have been aware of our study recently and are considering how to incorporate it into the transformation. I still, in what I'm seeing the money being directed towards, it does not appear to be, perhaps as much as I would like to see, focused on getting a real understanding of the impact of things, as both Andrea and Joyce have mentioned, the effect of how officers are given jobs, what jobs they're given, how frequently they change. We're doing some relatively quick fixes there, but I'm not sure it's gotten to the real depth of the issue and presenting to officers a long-term ability to make a contribution over a lengthy career, hopefully more than 15 or 20 years, that it doesn't require them to check specific blocks and to put their personal career ahead of anyone else so that they can continue to feed their family and continue to remain in the organization. The up-and-out policy is a major issue for officers to be able to actually develop professionally and see where they can make a contribution in the organization.
And so in sum, what needs to be done?
Our recommendation was a thorough look at the personnel management systems as they change and affect the professional identity, how officers and NCOs see themselves as members of a profession, not just a government bureaucracy, and looking for ways that you can still use a centralized system that ensures fairness and provides opportunities for this diverse military, but still encourages a professional identity and the development of this professional expertise and the ability to apply it throughout the world.
Colonel Watkins, thank you very much for joining us for this first part of our discussion on the military life on The Connection. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. If you're in the services and you know something about this, we'd like to hear from you. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the military life, the money that's set aside for it, whether or not it's enough, and whether or not that's the whole story. We'd like to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest today, Joyce Razor, she is Associate Director of Government Relations for the National Military Family Association. Andrea Stone is a reporter with USA Today who covers the military. And joining us now on the line from a beach in Delaware, Dr. David Siegel. He's Director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. David, can I ask you, on this issue of the crisis of the quality of life in the military and the crisis of confidence, which one do you think is the bigger problem right now?
I think it's very difficult to separate them. I guess that the biggest problem that I see is not so much the material factors of the quality of life, things like pay and infrastructure, those are clearly factors, but the context that we use to define for our military personnel the importance of what they're doing. I think that the ambiguity of a sense of mission and the pressures that we've put on the forces through downsizing have led to negative feelings about the services and their mission that make personnel less willing to accept the kinds of sacrifices we have asked of them.
Do you mean negative feelings inside or outside the forces?
Primarily inside. Negative feelings about the missions that they are being asked to perform, in part because we went through a period when they were told that what we were asking them to do was unimportant. In part, negative feelings based on a sense that their own superiors within the services are not giving them either the support they need or, in more direct terms, the equipment that they need to do their jobs or the personnel for their units that they need to do their jobs.
Let's go to the sharp end of the spear on this and bring our listeners into the conversation. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK is the number to join the Military Life Connection this hour. And John is calling from Portsmouth, Virginia. Hello, John.
Good morning. Very interesting discussion. I worked with the military, the civilian side, for about 18 years. I think part of the problem is, which is being addressed apparently from what we've heard today, is this up and out business. The military officers certainly should have a chance to stay in longer and pay back some of the benefits they've gotten by contributing. Certainly there's a big drag on the cost of the military is the retirement of officers. At 20 years, at 43 or 4 years old, pulling down a very large retirement. From the enlisted point of view, I believe that a longer stay at a particular location would help them a lot. This business about the people being on welfare is just sort of a paper tiger thing, or whatever you want to use the right expression. There's just a handful of people that get in and, have a large family right away in the first tour of duty. They could be hurting. There's no doubt about that. But a lot of military, I've had friends retire from the military and say, hey, gee, I was doing a lot better than I thought I was. There's a tremendous amount of tax-sheltered benefits, housing, and food that they have. After the first 4 years, they do get fairly good pay. Now, some of the military that are in high...
John, let me interrupt you if you wouldn't mind for a minute there, because I'm interested in hearing from Joyce on the point that you raised about soldiers living on welfare being a bit of a canard, something that is not necessarily representative of military life. It's something that Joyce works on specifically. Joyce, can you speak to that?
Well, I think the caller's right that there are actually very few, if we define welfare as food stamps. There are actually very few military families on food stamps. The caller's right. Most of them are people, junior enlisted with big families. Big families they brought into the military with them, living on an installation. The food stamp eligibility rules say that the value of the housing on base is not counted as part of the eligibility formula. So you have folks on base who have forfeited their housing allowance, living in on-base housing, who can qualify for food stamps, whereas when Andrea was talking about that disparity with the off-base folks, that the allowance doesn't help, well, the allowance doesn't help them cover the cost of adequate housing a lot of times, but it does keep them off food stamps. So the folks off the base are in worse shape, can't get food stamps. There's a lot more folks than the few thousand on food stamps who are in financial difficulty, however, and we deal with these populations. They're in difficulty for a lot of reasons, because they move often and their relocation expenses aren't reimbursed completely. The DOD did a survey. It said families on average lose $1,000 every time they move. Well, these young families don't have that kind of cushion. Mm-hmm. Inability to find a spouse a job and work childcare issues, the deployment factors into that. If the military member is gone, there's the backup babysitter so that the spouse can go out and work a night shift somewhere, wait tables. So that income's gone. Lack of good financial education, although the services are working on that. But there are a lot of reasons folks are in financial difficulty, and there's a lot more folks in financial difficulty than those food stamp numbers would indicate.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to make the military connection. Thanks to John for calling in. Julia is calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Julia, you're making the connection.
Good morning. I was just calling regarding our 10-year service with the military. My husband was in the Navy, and he was working as a custom home builder before we went into the military and was into electronics, so he got involved in that. And for 10 years he did that. He did two WESPACs, which is basically cruising on the West Coast.
Right.
And we lived in neighborhood housing through the whole period of our tenure, and we felt really patriotic in performing these services for our country. We at times held down, my husband held down three jobs, military and then two part-time, and I worked the whole time.
Is that because you needed the money, Julie? Is that...
Yes, we needed the money. I know that the services were available for budgeting classes and things of that nature. We had three children. When we went in, we already had two. The medical was terrific for us. It worked well. We were in California in Long Beach and then came out this way. But my husband got out after 10 years because he had gotten this education that was in high demand in the civilian world, and he's making a nice living working as a government contractor for the government.
So
I think that really points out a real problem that your husband got out after 10 years, and he's exactly the kind of person that the military wants to keep on board. And in the new budget, they're putting aside money. President Bush has said he's going to give $1.4 billion for pay, but he's going to give targeted pay for those mid-career E-4s to E-5s and mid-grade officers, and especially those who've got high-tech skills that are really lucrative on the outside, because they don't want people like your husband to leave. And that is a big problem.
My husband left for many reasons. For one thing, he didn't like his... The chief regarding our president at the time and his rules. And another would be the fact of there was a lot of demands, and he was very much a family person, and it was taking a lot of family time away, and just thought that it would be better if he had gotten out. He wasn't particularly fond of a retirement.
Were you also, Julia, were you also conscious of this family issue, thinking that life outside the military would be better for you and the family?
I wasn't real sure. I knew what I had always worked in the private sector, so I knew it was available to me. As far as what was available for him, I wasn't really sure. He made that decision, but I stressed to him before he got out of the military, he was to find something that would take care of his family before he left.
Julia, thanks very much for joining us on the line today. Can I just get a quick word from David Siegel? Because one of the things Julia said early on was that they were really happy, that their family was really happy to join the military to make their patriotic contribution, to make whatever sacrifice was necessary. I'm wondering if people, in some sense, David, are losing that degree of commitment on those terms.
I don't think we're losing it. I don't think the services or the nation have capitalized on that. Back in the days of conscription, we used to make it very clear that serving in the military was an expectation of citizens, that the nation had a right to call on people to help provide for the common defense. When we shifted to an all-volunteer force in 1973, we began to emphasize the material benefits of service more than the patriotic element. Interestingly, if you do surveys of military personnel today and ask them why they joined, you still find over half of them indicating that they joined at least in part for patriotic reasons. And I don't know that that's any lower than it used to be. And that's despite the fact that we're not telling them that you should join the military to serve your country. So I am not convinced that we've lost the patriotic element. There's another theme that Julia alluded to, however, that is important. One of the areas that we have seen a shift in American youth is the degree to which young American men want to participate in family life and in the raising of their children. 20 years ago, it was common for young men to feel that their job was to be the breadwinner and their wives would raise the kids. Now young men want to play a more active role in their families. And one of the problems that the military has in recruiting is that they do not perceive the military as a family-friendly employer in those regards.
Is that an accurate view, Joyce?
Well, I think it is. If Dad is in Bosnia doing peacekeeping. Dad can't come to the parent-teacher conference at the school or coach the Little League team. And we do see families that want parents that want to be involved in their children's lives, their family life, very involved in schools. Education is a very, very important thing. When I go to my kids' schools on the first day of school, I see lots and lots of uniforms, uniform parents bringing their kids to school the first day of school to emphasize how important education is. This is a good thing, but it does put a strain against the mission because and the services are starting to work on this, starting to work on the communications. We can now, you know, through email, a school can send communications to the deployed dad or the dad or mom on the ship, just as they can to the home computer. So there can be some more information, more involvement, but it's not the same thing as being there. And that is an issue when people are sitting down at the kitchen table saying, do I stay in?
Right.
Do I get out? That family time is one of the decision factors.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to make the connection. And Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'm a retiring CW4 aviator from the Army. I want to make a couple of points. I'm enjoying your discussion. The whole concept behind our reduction of force was to make us 40% smaller, better funded, better trained, better equipped. And we're not. We have not received that support. We're doing more missions now than we were back when we were a full-size force during the Cold War and the German border. I've always felt that troops do not work for money. They serve out a sense of patriotism, a greater purpose. It's difficult for them to sell to their families a lifestyle that is so difficult, where they go away for longer periods of time, where their families have no contact with them. You can work troops harder, and you can treat them, or you can treat them worse, but you can't do both.
Steve, just what's a CW4, so I know?
I'm Chief Warrant Officer, 4th.
And when you're saying that you want better tools to be a better soldier, are you saying that's equally as important as knowing that your family is in a comfortable situation when you're posted somewhere else?
That's correct. Tools in terms of the equipment, of the training, the funding for parts, it doesn't exist. The troops are now just working on threadbare systems.
And so when we see these billions and billions of dollars being directed to brand new weapon system and research and development, how is that received among the enlisted people?
It's important. It's important to know that the systems you have that you feel are becoming obsolete are going to be replaced with something that will serve in the future, but it does not do a whole lot for the situation that you're in when you're in a place like Kosovo or Bosnia. You need parts, you need equipment, you need training. You know, this whole idea of a highly technical, smaller force has just not transpired. We have not trained our troops the way that we need to.
Steve, thanks a lot for that observation. It's a good point.
Thanks very much.
Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Maria is calling from Virginia Beach. Maria, you're making the connection.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Great conversation. Love your show. I just think right now this is just so relevant to me. I'm a military spouse, and we're leaving. I married my husband late on in his career, established officer, and we're leaving Virginia Beach. I'm thrilled to finally be leaving this area.
Do you mean leaving the service or just leaving the location?
No, leaving the area, okay. Leaving the area of Virginia Beach. I married him, as I said, later on in his career, and I was established professionally in Washington, D.C., and it has been nothing but a drain on me since we've been down here. And, you know, as much as I try and as much as I tried to establish myself, it was the same thing, especially since this area is just flushed with military spouses, and which drives the economics all the way down in the area for what they will pay for positions or what's available. So I know that varies on the post that we will be going to, and hopefully it'll be better in the next spot. But that's just pretty much what my comment is. I'm just, as I said, I'm just glad to finally be going on and be able to try to get back into the job market and really excel. So that's pretty much it.
Thanks for bringing that point to us. Joyce, can I get you to speak to Maria on that?
Well, Maria, there's a lot of Marias in the military. We have a lot of educated spouses across the board, enlisted officer, and the frustration is very real. There are a lot of, if you look on the map at where military installations are, there are a lot of places out in rural areas, concentrations of military, like at Virginia Beach, that just tend to drive down economic benefits for spouses trying to find jobs. Spouse employment is an issue. And when that family's sitting around the table deciding whether to stay in or get out, if a spouse has found a good job, sometimes the family will say, okay, now's the time for the member to get out. We can't move again and start over again. What spouses also find is that most states don't pay unemployment compensation when a military spouse follows the military member to a new assignment. They deem that as a choice move and not a termination, and they don't get unemployment compensation. So at a time when a family's finances are already being strained during a move, they've got this extra loss of income. The spouse employment issue is becoming more and more real, and we are hearing from military members that that's a reason why they're getting out, is because of the frustration with the spouses in finding a job or a career progression.
Andrea Stone, I'm wondering, in your work as a journalist covering these issues, are the messages getting through? The sort of thing that we're hearing from Maria.
I think it is getting through. I mean, the quality of life is a real when these reviews that the new Secretary Rumsfeld has put together, one of them was quality of life, looking at all the issues of health care and housing and the infrastructure. And I think they know that there is a problem, and I think that they are, with the pay raises, with the increase in retirement benefits, health care for retirees, they are trying to address it. It's going to take a while. I know that one of the things that they would really like to do is close some bases. They have 25% more bases than they have people to be on those bases, and they think if they can just get rid of some of this infrastructure, they can really put that money into helping the quality of life.
We'll talk more about that as the connection continues. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you on the issue of the way the government is planning to spend money to improve life for people in the military. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio, and this hour we're talking about life in the military and whether or not the money that is being requested by the Pentagon at present is the sort of thing that's going to repair the problems that exist within that life. My guests are Joyce Razor. She's Associate Director of Government Relations for the National Military Family Association. Andrea Stone is a reporter with USA Today who covers the military, and Dr. David Siegel is Director of Research for on military organization at the University of Maryland. When we took our break, Dr. Siegel, Andrea was moving to something that I wanted to ask you about, and that is, how can Washington, in its efforts to try and address quality of life using money, also address what you brought into the conversation, which is this crisis of confidence? How do they get at that?
I think in part it's a matter of how they choose to spend that money. And clearly, when they say we're going to improve infrastructure, we're going to improve pay, that's a positive signal. When the legislature says we're going to keep bases open that the military knows don't need to be opened, or we're going to buy weapon systems that the military didn't ask for because the manufacturer happens to be in a particular congressman's constituency, that sends a very different message, and there's an awful lot of that going on. I think that spending the money in ways that sends positive signals to the members of the military is tremendously important.
Give me a specific example of a way the money should be spent that you're talking about.
Well, for example, if you look at the defense budget in any given year, you're going to find literally billions of dollars spent upon weapon systems that the military did not ask for, but that specific congressmen want to have purchased because the manufacturers in their district. Mm-hmm. When the military sees the money being spent on things that they didn't ask for, and Washington saying, but we are giving this money to the military, the folks in the military say, no, you're not.
Right.
You're giving it to the manufacturers. And that leads them to feel that there are more important things to the people in Washington than the soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines out in the field.
1-800-423-8255 is our telephone number, 1-800-423-TALK, to join the conversation about military life in the United States. And Joe is calling from Suffolk, Virginia. Hi, Joe. You're making the connection.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, I'm an active duty Navy chief. I've got a little over 20 years. I spent 13 years at sea. One of the issues I'd like to address as far as morale, and I found my last tour on a destroyer, was so frustrating is that the Navy, would they have a surplus of the CO commander level officers that they're running them through at a rate of about every 12 to 17 months or cycling them through as
through what? Running them through what do you mean, Joe?
As COs of ships.
Right.
And what happens is, and same with the executive officer, there are about 12 to 15 months. Is for the crew, for the enlisted crew, we're there for 4 to 5 years. You're changing out the leadership somebody every year, and it becomes so difficult to do your job because you're constantly having to readapt to your boss. And they implement a lot of changes and never see the results of it because they've moved on. It's kind of interesting talking to senior officers in the Navy. I brought it up to several. One says, well, it is a training issue and is affecting our ability. One says, well, as a chief, we know it's a problem, but just keep your head down and just continue to do your job. And one says, well, I don't see any problem. And if you were to go and talk in a chief's mess, they'll tell you the same thing. Because of that, that CO has such a short time there, he can't afford mistakes to happen. So they create a zero defect mentality. So the young officers are not allowed to make the mistakes and grow. Instead, they're micromanaged, and that's one of the reasons I see that the Navy cannot hold on to its junior officers.
In your experience, Joe, is this also a problem in the Army and the Air Force?
Oh, I have no doubt. When I read the article talking about the Army zero defect mentality and micromanagement, there's no doubt that senior officer has 1 year. He's got to make his mark, and he cannot afford to let that junior officer make a mistake. When I first came into service in 1979, the COs were there for 28 to 30 months. So they were allowed to make a mistake and recover from it with a 12. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I was just going to say, that's absolutely right. I think the Army is having a real problem keeping captains. They're just leaving in droves. And but I think the technology has a lot to do with it. I mean, in the Navy, maybe 200 years ago, they'd send a ship out, and maybe 2 years it would come back, and that captain was in charge all along. Now we've got email and teleconferencing and instant communication so that people back in Washington and the Pentagon can get right down to your level and send commands, and there's a lot of autonomy has been lost through technology. So I think there's a real problem, and it is for all the services.
Joe, thanks for bringing that to our attention. That was Andrea Stone of USA Today talking in response to the point that you raised. Let's move along. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and Ted is calling the connection from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Ted.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to take a little different stand, if I might, hoping I don't ruffle somebody's feathers.
Go ahead, ruffle some feathers.
I have a grandson that's been approached by a recruiting sergeant to just finishing high school, and it would appear that they're offering practically the moon to this kid. I just wonder whether that's practical in today's youth. I'm talking now, granted I served in the service a long time back, which is no similarity. But they're offering, for example, 212 different jobs. He could have his choice. They're offering him $50,000 after 4 years if he should decide to leave. They're offering him a great bonus if he should stay after the 4 years.
What's your concern here, Ted? Do you think they're lying to him? Or
I think that, A, either they're lying to him because it seems almost unbelievable they can afford that much can be afforded to every new recruit, or the government is so hard up for people that they have to offer the moon and maybe not can afford it. I mean, your previous speakers have been talking about more money to the present troops. I'm just wondering whether we're not spending too much to get new troops. Is it that hard to get new candidates to recruit? That's my question, I guess.
Yes, it is. There are a lot more opportunities for that traditional recruiting pool, like your grandson, the kid in high school. A lot more of them are going to college, so the recruiters are facing a tougher battle. That's one reason they're looking at some different demographic populations. They're looking at that young high school graduate who's defied the demographic trends, has married young, had children. That's another new good recruiting pool for them. But it is hard to recruit. And the services are now saying, because it is so expensive to recruit, let's focus on some retention, because everyone we can keep in is somebody less we have to recruit. And so that's why the services are looking at some of the quality of life issues, looking at these other issues that influence retention, looking at the training. And I think it's very important to say that training is a part of quality of life. Families worry if the service member is training with unsafe equipment. We know this is a dangerous occupation, and we want it as safe as possible. So, but you're absolutely right. They're having to offer more. The services are making their recruitment quotas, but it's hard. They have to offer a lot because the recruiting pool has shrunk, and fewer people have a connection with the military. So there's a lot more education that has to be done about the military lifestyle to get somebody in. But there's a lot more options out there for these young folks.
One last comment, if I may, and that is that I'm quite sure that my grandson is all intentions of going to college after 4 years in the service, which I would appear to me would defeat the purpose of what they're offering him. Maybe I'm incorrect on that, but unless he finds a niche that just happens to suit him, at least his father thinks he's going to college, put it that way.
Ted, thanks a lot for your call. David Siegel, I'm interested in knowing in your research whether or not you've concluded that this great campaign, the Army of One, out chasing after the high school kids like this, isn't a little bit misguided and a bit of the kind of disconnect or crisis that you were describing.
Well, there's a lot of controversy over the Army of One campaign that I think is in part driven by a misunderstanding of what it's about. The Army has realized that the current generation of youth has a different set of values and different value orientations than the people who came before them. They are in some ways more individualistic, and that's what the Army of One sounds like. And for that reason, in fact, a lot of people in the Army today don't like that slogan. It's in fact rooted in the same social psychological theory of motivation as the Army's very successful Be All That You Can Be campaign, which is also very individualistic. The fact is that that campaign is resonating among American youth. The number of hits on the Army recruiting system homepage since that slogan hit the airwaves has gone up by factors of hundreds. So it is talking to the youth of today. It is clear that the recruiting business has gotten expensive. Now, a lot of the expense of what the caller was talking about, I suspect, was educational benefits that are, in fact, aimed specifically to get college-oriented youth to come into the military before they go to college, because that is the mental aptitude that we need in the military today to man the kinds of weapon systems, the high-tech systems that we have now. One of the big problems that the military has in recruiting is everybody is not mentally qualified to serve. They really try to sample from the top of the distribution. And the major competition is not other entry-level jobs, it's higher education. And a larger and larger proportion of each high school graduating class is going to college rather than joining the military. And the task for the military is to get them to serve for some period before going on to college.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio, and Stephen, you're on the line. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Great show. You could do hours on this subject. Retired Lieutenant Colonel, I was stationed in Boston my last tour. I think it's interesting also to note that if you look at the Academy, the Air Force, Navy, and Army, the Academy graduates that are getting out, especially women, Air Force pilots, many of whom graduated in the top of their class, are sought after very highly by the airlines and leave in droves. Lots of kids leaving the Navy, Annapolis grads for MBA programs. Procter & Gamble wants them all, and they have a huge Navy contingent at that company, let alone others.
So are you suggesting that the services should offer them more money so they don't go through the training and then bail?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think that it's a great training ground when you train your officers, but you're not doing very much to get them to stay after 5 or 6 years. They're getting a nice free education. They probably give you back some money in the 5 years, but what do we get out of the long term? I think it's something that needs to be addressed, and I think it's a big problem, especially with female grads.
Thank you very much for bringing that to the program, Steve. Andrea, do you hear this from the women in the services you interview?
I think that women are having the same problems that the men are. I mean, there's at least until recently, there was a real thriving economy out there that had a lot to offer to them. I know that in terms of pilots, male or female, the new administration is even thinking about training more pilots than they actually need to help the airlines who think in 10 years from now they're going to have a shortage of pilots. And, of course, they get the vast majority of their pilots from the military. They get free training. So that's sort of part of the Pentagon's new getting more like private business and thinking more like the private sector. But I think there is a lot of frustration. You know, for women, they have a problem at least in the Army and in the Marines that they are not allowed to be in ground combat, and that's still the way up. But things have improved because now in the Air Force and the Navy, they can fill almost 98-99% of the billets. They now command ships. They are fighter pilots. They have been in combat. So I think a lot of the ceiling has come down, but there's still some of it there.
Joyce Razor, quick last comment to you. You are your husband is still in the military, and we've heard a lot of calls this hour from people who are detailing reasons why people leave. Why is your family staying in?
Well, my husband's approaching retirement, so he will be getting out soon. We've stayed in because the career satisfaction for him has been good. He's had a variety of different kinds of jobs, gotten to work in different places. It's the lifestyle. It's also the sense of service. I mean, my husband and a lot of his peers are very patriotic. Do believe that they are serving the country and that there's a value in serving the country. And military folks, everybody I talk to, the families believe there's a value in serving the country. They're just saying, how much of a sacrifice should we have to make in terms of our family's quality of life to serve the country? And that's what needs to be recognized.
That's the question. You're absolutely right. It's the same thing that Joe was saying when he called in. I want to thank all my guests for taking the time out to join us. To Joyce Razor, Associate Director of Government Relations at the National Military Family Association. Andrea Stone, reporter for USA Today. Earlier we were talking with retired Colonel Gail Watkins and also Dr. David Siegel from the University of Maryland. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Connection listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website at theconnection.org. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.